This is an Irreverent podcast. Check out irreverent.fm for shows from all our friends. Hello and welcome to Exvangelical, a show exploring the world inside and outside the evangelical subculture. I'm your host, Blake Chastain. I've got another author interview for you today, featuring my talk with Jason Kirk, author of the new book, Hell is a World Without You. Jason is also an editor at The Atlantic, which is part of the New York Times, and a podcaster in his own right. He has a show called Vacation Bible School, as well as the Shutdown Fullcast. I really enjoyed Jason's book, Hell is a World Without You. He is a novelist. This book is a novel. And oftentimes I interview folks who write nonfiction books. And I take a little bit of a different tact with novelists. And really, instead of trying to spoil any part of a book, I really try to understand part of the creative process. Because by and large, I am not a fiction writer. And it is just a completely foreign type of thinking and writing to me. It's not a way that, as much as I appreciate fiction, it's not a medium that I have ever really worked in before personally. And so I'm always fascinated by the nuts and bolts of what goes into that. And Hell is a World Without You really puts you in the place of a evangelical teenager, a male evangelical teenager. In particular, as the point of view character for the book, and seeing as I was an evangelical teenager, it really hit home. And I think that if you haven't checked this book out already, if that is something that you would like to experience again or understand for the first time, I recommend this book for it, because it will very much put you in the mind and shoes of someone in the late 90s, early 2000s, going through all of that, all of purity culture, all of the hormones and hellfire and everything that goes into youth group culture. Check out the book. You will find a link to my bookshop in the show notes, as well as a link to Jason's website and everything else. And please subscribe to my newsletter, the Post Evangelical Post, because all of my ideas begin as puns. Check it out at postevangelicalpost.com. You can subscribe for free, or for $5 a month, or $50 a year. You will get additional short form podcasts around once a week, as well as ad-free feeds for this show and other things. And I've got a big announcement coming in the next week or two, so please go over there and subscribe so you can be one of the first to learn about it. You can also follow me on Instagram and Threads at brchastain_. All right, let's get into it. Today I'm speaking to Jason Kirk, co-host of the podcast Shutdown Fullcast and Vacation Bible School, as well as the author of the new novel, Hell is a World Without You. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hey, Blake. Thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
Thanks. I really enjoyed reading through your book. And before we get to the book, I do want to go through sort of the standard questions that I ask all my guests on the show. And I really like to start at the beginning, which is with where you grew up and what your first experiences with religion were like.
So I was born in Atlanta. And as far as I know, my first church was First Baptist Atlanta, where right around that time, or maybe shortly before, the pastor was Charles Stanley, who was president of the Southern Baptist Convention. So that's how Southern Baptist my starting point is. we moved around Metro Atlanta, wound up at, it sampled a variety of mostly Southern Baptist churches that sort of spanned from the semi-charismatic to the semi-fundamentalist spectrum. Yeah. My teenage years were at First Baptist Woodstock, where the pastor Johnny Hunt was also at one point the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, and recently, a couple years ago, had a sex scandal. So yeah, my Southern Baptist bona fides, I would say, are pretty solid.
Yeah, I'd say so.
But yeah, I was a pretty hardcore youth group kid. You know, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, and then every other assorted event and camp and lock-in and accountability meeting and Awana and Bible study and on and
yeah,
on and on.
Yeah. Was that something that was self-motivated? Like, were you like on fire for God, sort of that type of youth group kid?
Oh, I sure tried to be. It was I was going to be in attendance whether I wanted to be or not. And there were certainly spans of my adolescence when I did not want to be, but couldn't see a way out of it. But yeah, it was like one part, this is what our family does, this is what is going to happen. And it was also one part, like, all the things that I would rather be doing in church feel like they will get me sent to hell more quickly. So I better be here. And then, you know, eventually it's like, this is where all my best friends are. So in a way, this is where I really want to be. Not for the reasons that I think I want to be here. You know what I mean?
Like, right. Absolutely. So like, I mean, so you were a cradle Southern Baptist, but you moved around a couple of times, but did you just always sort of show up at youth group? And I mean, youth group is such a powerful thing because of those ready-made built-in friendships that can happen there, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I was actually in elementary school. I still have no idea how we afforded it. I was a private school Baptist kid, and then I was homeschooled in middle school. So like it was round the clock. And then public school and high school, when I you're raised in a lots of high control religious world, tell you that like public school it's just a cesspool of demonic indoctrination. And like, oh, here's a Carmen song about how everyone there is addicted to condoms and astrology. And, you know, you're just taught it's the most evil place in the world. And, you know, a couple years into public school, and it was like, I don't quite think that's true. It feels pretty normal. Like, you know, I have this crew and then I have the mega church, and it's like the same, you know. and yeah, the youth group thing, it was this complicated thing where, sure, it's there to keep you coming and to keep you attending and in a mega church to keep you tithing, and to like develop relationships that enables you to become married at age like 19, and then your kids can be funneled into youth group. So like it's got that, but then it also has what I found, at least the benefit of the mega church world, was like, if you pack 1,000 kids into an auditorium, that means there are 50 to 200 kids who are a little bit full of doubts, and maybe they'll find each other, you know, and maybe they start talking a little too much. So, in a way, going to a really, really big church with a huge youth group ended up being pretty beneficial for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that being like, being one of many versus maybe at a smaller youth group, you might just be the only solitary doubter before there were things like social media with hashtags and all sort of other ways to find like-minded people.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Like right before the rise of social media, it was like, what did we have? You know, Rich Mullins songs, you know, or like, maybe find a Brendan Manning book.
Oh yeah.
Maybe you get really hopped up on like the one quote on the DC Talk song. And, that leads you to, lead you to liberation, but that was about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then and later in the 2000s, maybe finding Pedro the Lion fans.
Yes.
So what was the time frame with going towards your book? You know, this took place in the high school student that's the point of view character for your book was in the early 2000s. Was that also the same time frame for you, or were you a little before or after that? That you were going through this?
I was very slightly before. Okay. I moved the time frame slightly because I wanted 9/11 to hit right in the middle of these characters' high school years. But yeah, very slightly before for me. The like, you know, constant countdown to the rapture, that was more our vibe.
Yeah, the year 2000 when, like, coming up.
Yeah. rapture panic sort of dipped just a bit in the 2000s until there was another Democratic president, and then they latched back onto that,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I get a sense we're probably around the same age. I'm 40. So like 9/11 happened at the very beginning of my freshman year at college, which was a Christian college. So it was in a way sort of an extension of high school for, in a lot of ways. But what about for you? Like, you had these really, really formative experiences in megachurch places. Did you stay on fire, like going into your college years? What happened after the youth group phase?
It was this, I remember a lot of things about that time. One was, I sort of had this like dazed and confused situation where it was like, I'm kind of still lingering around youth group, 'cause like, this is where all my friends were. And it feels very creepy to go into something called singles ministry when I've been, you know, I've been driving a car for 2 years and you want me to get married, yeah. You know, like it just didn't click. I did not recognize myself as an adult at all, mm-hmm. You know? And so that lasted through like, at least a few months. And then it was like, okay, at the same time, hanging around the high school sophomores is equally creepy. So there's like nowhere for me at church, you know?
Right.
So at that point it was just like, I was totally unplugged from the friend making portion of it. And it was just like, I'll show up on Sunday morning. And it was, looking back, I see all sorts of not just theological doubts, but also doubts about like, hey, we have this enormous building that costs tons of money and like homeless people still exist. I remember a moment, and I put a little bit of this in the book where the protagonist church sort of becomes very prosperity gospel-y, but like it didn't go as hard as my real life megachurch did. Where there was a moment when I recall going out just, you know, middle of a service, like, I'm just, everything's off, I'm not feeling this, going out into like the foyer and seeing a diorama of the new sanctuary that they were going to be building. And it was like, you know, it looked like something I could have made in Sim City. And I'm like, what in the world does this have to do with anything that, you know, that Jesus said? And it was just all of these things that now, you know, nowadays on social media, there's like ready-made arguments to counter it. Like, you know, I don't like the way that my friends who are female feel about the things that are said about the bodies of young women mm-hmm. in church. I don't like that. And it's like, well, okay, that's a me problem then. I want them to be more sinful. Like that was the only counter there was at the time. So like, it wasn't this like fully played out discourse that you could tap into, you know, it was just sort of like you just slap a Band-Aid on each doubt as it
yeah.
arises.
Yeah.
And then just try not to think about it. And like a couple of my friends came out around that time. And I remember this feeling of like, I want to have their back. I care more about them than I do about the pastor who's telling me they're wrong. And so that's like wrestling with what we were told the Bible says. And just all those things started to add up. And the groundwork that had been laid was, all of this is my problem. You know, like we've been told for years, like we had the thing, you know, like first youth group of ninth grade, it's like, look to your right, look to your left. Two of you will quit church by the time you start college. And it's like, no, won't be me. Right.
Yeah.
So that freshman year of college, it's still stuck in my head of like, no, I can't be the one to let us all down. But I was, you know, and other people noticed it before I did. I remember a day I was just walking from one class to the next at college, and like three people from some other church descended on me and were like, Hey, you look like you could use some good news. Would you like to go get coffee with us? You know, like doing the entire sales pitch. And I'm like, what? You know, like this is what I sound like, you know? And it was just like, no, I don't want to. I'd know there's nothing for me there. I already know it. And, so it was like, even as the theological and political doubts are piling up, I'm still, you know, and I'm doing all my little rebellions and all that, you know, and doing all the general coming of age stuff and getting as much trouble as I possibly can. In a lot of ways, still very much a church kid, got married to she's still my wife. We met on a Project 86 message board, Tooth and Nail
wow.
Records band.
Wow.
and like we got married while I was still in college, mm-hmm. you know, so very, very, very church kid behavior. Had a kid, not super early, but early by the standards of like people on social media today who say you shouldn't get married until you're 39.
Right. Yeah.
but yeah, she was raised Nazarene, like chill Nazarene. You know, it's a pretty wide spectrum, so, but like any denomination.
Yeah, you can, you can deep dive on this show. So like, I mean, the Nazarene kids that before I moved to the Chicago area, they were the ones that wore denim skirts to high school, you know?
Yes. Okay.
So like those were the Nazarenes that I knew personally. But I didn't, I just knew them as classmates, but that was the sort of style. And that was, that's closer to my background, which is Methodist, Wesleyan, holiness movement people over here instead of the Baptist side.
It's, whenever I say like she was raised Nazarene, people are like, ooh, and I'm like, oh no, no, she was like way more chill and progressive than I was, you know? And it's funny because like you marry a Nazarene and you just end up knowing a lot about the Nazarenes, but like they're very much a broad spectrum where a lot of them are like, you know, yeah, evolution is real. And then there's a lot of like very hardcore conservatives. But she's remained basically the same religion-wise ever since. Her political beliefs have drifted left, of course, which, you know, happens as you open your eyes a bit, at least I think that's what happens. And she was fine with me, you know, just not going to church anymore and not wanting to talk about religion anymore and fine with, you know, not pushing our kid to be baptized or whatever. And she's never pushed religion on our kid at all. And I certainly haven't. but we kind of didn't talk about religion for like the first 10 plus years of our marriage, which is wild. Cause like, it's basically how we met. Right. And then 2020, when, you know, the whole world fell apart, and I, you know, as a sports media person, there's no more sports. So therefore I had no more job. And then it's like, that summer, that fall of just sitting around and realizing like, oh, wow, this is the first time I've been alone with my thoughts in my entire life. Because like, you know, as a child, it was church around the clock and school, you know, school and spare moments when I wasn't at church. And like, you know, it was just like, oh, my God, this is what it sounds like in there. This sucks. And not knowing what else to do, me and my wife started a Bible podcast because I'd talked about religion on, you know, our, on my like sports podcast that just gets wildly off topic all the time. And people would respond to it in a way that pushed me toward it, you know?
Yeah.
So it was just sort of like, hey, you know, it'd be funny if we just started a Bible podcast and just like maybe learned some stuff and made some jokes and whatever. And within like 2 months, it was like, I'm learning a little bit too much stuff, you know, and I'm like kind of starting to unearth some things. And I was in denial about it for about a year. And around that time, I also started writing the novel because there was a day in my wife and I were standing in the kitchen and I just offhanded out of nowhere, just told a story like, hey, well, there's this Wednesday night in middle school, like, when, you know, it was before Columbine, and it's pretty bad when that's an important detail. when we were like, you know, sitting around doing youth group stuff and this group of men broke into the room and they're wielding rifles and like tactical body, whatever. And they're yelling, deny Christ or we'll shoot you. And like they drag a kid out, there's sound effects. We're all led to believe the kid was shot. And it's, you know, and then eventually they realize like, this was a skit, but when the Antichrist comes, it'll be real. And I told her the story and she was just like jaw on the floor. And I was like, what? What do you mean? That was just how church worked. That wasn't how church worked for you? Like, and so I was like, wow, I guess I better start writing a novel. And then, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, let's get to your book. I am curious, like what led you to, what drew you to turning that sort of experience and excuse me, stammering a little bit. What led you to wanting to turn this into a novel?
So I had done, you know, I'd done a bit of creative writing in college and like, honestly, as far back as middle school or whatever. So for me, that felt like my most like ground floor level writing mode. Like even, you know, as after years as a sports journalist, it feels like creative writing is still kind of home in a way. But I started writing it like as fiction, I think in some ways, because like, you know, it, like if it's nonfiction, that's just like what happened. I'm not a good enough, I don't know, thinker, I guess, to say, here's what happened. And here, you know, we're going to recontextualize it and think about it in so many ways without like moving things around. Whereas with fiction, it's like, okay, I can take these personality traits and put them in someone else, or I can take this event and see it from someone else's eyes, or, we can relocate it. I moved it from, you know, it was set like any town USA and I located it specifically in Pennsylvania. So no one could say, oh, this sounds like just Southern stuff. And it's like, no, it's not Southern stuff. It's not about the South at all. But yeah, like fiction just gave it a bit of, I guess, a bit of freedom to say even more things, yeah. I guess, about what was real than saying just the facts would have, I guess, because, you know, and then I can also like incorporate experiences other people have had, you know, things I've learned from books and podcasts and like things like my friends have discovered 20 years later, like, oh yeah, that was a weird memory, you know? But yeah, I guess the freedom to move things around.
Sure.
That's probably what dreaming fiction.
One of the things, I mean, I mentioned before we started recording that I'll do my best to try to avoid sort of plot spoilers and that sort of thing, but you have so many great themes throughout the book, as well as literary devices that you use. And I, as a reader, the one that kept just hitting home in an almost uncomfortable way was the device you used that was really these sort of like intrusive thoughts that just mm-hmm. like would just beat the shit out of your protagonist, Isaac. It's his thoughts, but there are these intrusive thoughts that he thinks are essentially like the Holy Spirit or some sort of conviction. And then you put it in, and that's in bold, and then you put his response to those thoughts in italics. And like, that was where, you know, to me, it was like, this could only have been written by someone who actually thought this way at one point. You know, like that was it was sort of wild to see that represented, and it put me back in those like in those places of like hormones and hellfire. Like that was like teenage mm-hmm. youth group, right? And how did you begin to develop that? Because to me, that was the one that as it evolves throughout the book, that was the one that really blew me away. Like what was behind the development of that, and why was that such an important part to incorporate into the novel?
I think one of the places it came from was just wanting to show a reader who wasn't there, and B, a reader who was, like how hard it is to challenge things within this world. Like how much programming is already in your head by the time you're 13. Like you can't, like, I guess maybe one of the things that I definitely wanted to take on is whenever I talk about religion, I talk about, you know, like this was very, very hard for us when we were 15. I'll get someone who wasn't there who'll say to me, oh, well, it wouldn't have worked on me. You know, they'll say it in a nicer way than that, but yeah. They'll say it in a really cocky way. We're like, oh, I like to question stuff when I was 15. You know, I went to Catholic church for 9 minutes, so I know what it's like. I would simply spin on my heels and explain atheism to them. And it's like, I wanted a way to show them like, no, you're wrong. If you were raised like me, you would have thought like me until, you know, somewhere between 15 and 25. So like I needed this, some sort of a dynamic to show that like, it is not as easy as when you're 14 determining that everyone around you is lying to you, right? Like your entire brain is screaming at you that no, they're right. Right. Because they built your brain. So like, I started out, the device I used at first was a Jenga tower, and it was like this, you know, this perfect stack of opinions, and you have to keep it level until you die or else, right? And it's like, well, okay, but one of my friends just came out at school and I want to remain her friend. So like, whoops, there goes that piece, you know, and like, uh-oh, this other friend just read Jurassic Park and learned a little bit about evolution and gender roles. Whoops, there goes two pieces, you know? And like, it was a pretty decent, like image in this kid's head, this tower just falling apart throughout the course of the book. But like, I wanted it to fight back and push back. It's not just there, it's trying to preserve itself. And so I settled on like, just, hey, it's a book. We're looking at words. Let's just use words. The words are, you know, like different people have different kinds of heads. Some people see pictures, some people hear words. So let's go all in on this kid hears words. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it is, there are some things I definitely share with the protagonist, some things I share with other characters, but like that hearing words thing is very, very much like, I cannot imagine a brain that's anything but
right,
words.
Right,
right. And there is a meme from the computer game SimCity 2000 where one of the, promises going somewhere, where the transit advisor is like all caps screaming, "No, you can't cut back on funding. You will regret this." And it's this, it's in the game, you have like six people and they're all screaming at you and there's no way to appease them all. But that "you will regret this," I just latched onto that. And that voice over and over and over is screaming at this kid about every thought he has. "You will regret this." Because like ultimately, what is hell, damnation, all of it? It is, hey, every single thing you're doing right now, you'll regret it for all eternity. You better stop. You better, you know. So I sort of just latched onto regret, which eventually found it like it tied in with, you know, we learn in the first sentence he's not quite grieving his father. His father passed, but he has no clue how to grieve because of various other religious things put into his head. So like grief, regret, like this sense of whatever is gone is just, it can never be thought about ever again. Whatever you want, you should stop thinking about it because it too should be buried. And then the like the intrusive thoughts element, I mean, I've experienced a bit of that to some extent, and like non-religious things, but like it is awful when it's religious stuff because it's not just like, oh, I want to do this dangerous thing even though I actually don't. It's like, oh, my soul is on the line and I want to do this dangerous thing, you know, mm-hmm. like.
Yeah.
And then the wild thing is a month or two ago, I read it like on a like plane flight, you know, a plane flight or two. And it was just like the whole time I'm like, holy shit, this kid's head sucks. This is what it sounded like up until I put it in this book and made other people look at it. Like, it's just like, my God, this kid's skull is so mean right. to him. It was like, I don't know. It really is like I dumped it out of my brain and put it in this product. I don't know.
Yeah.
Which.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's where I feel like it was very successful in sort of, you know, being representative of like a teenage boy's just the style of thought and like the things that preoccupied him. And the things that the way in which he thought about things, like it was, I think that was very successful. And the other thing that I also loved, just segueing with regards to literary devices, is the incorporation of like the instant messages and all of that, because that was absolutely, you know, of a time and just so incredibly formative. And like there's millions of elder millennials and Gen Xers that like that could read this and be like, oh, I remember. I remember what this was like. People changing usernames and like and all of that. And then like in addition to that, I mean, it's just so full of all of those pop culture references. Like were those things that you had to research or do you just have like that good of recall? Because I mean, I was definitely like, you know, brought back to that time by all the different mentions of both Christian and secular stuff throughout. But man, like, was that something that you had to do some refresher on, or do you just have that type of pop culture info like right at the top?
For whatever reason, there was like this kind of T.S. Eliot element to it where it's like everything that has ever happened is part of my it's part of my creative world. Like, I don't know, I got hooked on like Eliot in college and like hip-hop in high school, where it's, you know, where, you know, taking a bunch of sounds and references and combining them into something new. Mm-hmm. So like I just love that sense of here are a few words that come from something else. If you recognize their source, great. If you don't, we need to find a way to just keep moving anyway. You know, you derive some meaning from it, but it's fine if you don't know the source. As far as like researching it, I could have put a ton of that in here without doing any research, but you know, yeah, it was like, we need songs to show up when they were actually out. One of my copy editors, she found like 3 or 4 songs that I had out at the wrong time, which like, whew. One of them was an Outkast song, which like as an Atlantan, that was like, oh my God,
watch out.
That was the first time with this book about like religion that I was like, oh, I've done something blasphemous, you know? there was a lot of like, you know, video games that were in there, and then I'm like, it doesn't really fit. Like there was a lot of the kids are really into Metal Gear, and then it was like, well, but if they're into Diablo 2, there's a lot more theology that we can derive from Diablo 2. And there was, you know, like the movies they're into. Eventually settled on like Event Horizon. It's like, you know, the very, very ridiculous, goofy horror movie where the words "hell is only a word" are spoken, and like, hey, let's see how many ways we can twist that meaning around.
That movie messed me up, by the way. Like, I saw that. I swear, I think I was still in middle school, but the theater that in town, for whatever reason, I don't think my sister's 5.5 years older than me. I don't think she snuck me in, but that movie messed me up for like, I didn't sleep for like 2 weeks.
Was it because like part of your brain was like, but this is real?
I mean, there was that, and then just like, it was probably the first non-TV edited horror movie I'd ever seen, and like,
wow, okay.
And like, you know, a guy takes out his own eyes and people are flayed, and like, I mean, it's like, it's intense. And yes, I also thought that it was plausible.
Yes, that's the thing. Like, I remember I saw it with a room full of like church dudes who were like, you know, we were used to like trying to impress each other with what we could shrug off. You know, we saw that and we're all looking around like, who wants to go get baptized? You know, like, the next night when I was like by myself, it was like me and the homies all crashed at whichever's house. It was like rare that to like sleep alone, you know, but like the next night when I was sleeping alone, it was like, I'm going to fall asleep to some like praise and worship. But yeah, I wanted that like super hardcore horror stuff in there. Cause it's like, no, these kids aren't just like little, Flanders kids who have, you know, are not exposed to anything. Like, they can find the internet exists,
right?
You know, by this time they can find whatever they want. And like the thing about this era, as opposed to like right now, like the like 9/11 era, is like their parents don't know what they can find, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, this was actually like right before the advent of Covenant Eyes, as like, you know, as a like, we had similar things, but they couldn't keep up. You know, like, the kids were ahead in the arms race, let's put it that way. So, like,
absolutely,
we could find whatever we wanted to find, and our parents could not stop us. So, like, and a character mentions that at one point, like, you know, he's, like, just sort of lost and hopeless because, like, adults keep telling him to avoid porn. And he's like, you don't know how hard it is. You did not grow up with the internet, you know? he's like, one of the first teenagers who's ever had to do that, you know? So that sense of being in the middle of two eras, like, you know, there was a point in high school where we didn't have the internet at home. Then there's a point in high school where we had the internet in our pockets. It's insane to ask that of young people to, you know, to have that much instant freedom. And like at the same time, it was, as soon as we got our driver's licenses, no one could, you know, there weren't like trackers on our phones. So like we had this thing where we could have maps in our pockets, but no one could know where we were on the map. So yeah, there was a ton about that era that I found fun to write about, like, in a religious context and not a religious context. And, like, people who didn't grow up religious, it gives them a lot of stuff to latch onto, too. Like, you know, I've heard from a lot of people who weren't raised religious in any way, and they're like, all of this sounded completely relatable, other than sitting in church, I guess.
Right. Yeah. The other thing that... like going back to your comment about these teens like having unfettered access to porn and all that sort of stuff, like this was the height. Well, at least in my personal like timeline, it felt like the height. And even in retrospect, it was when I Kissed Dating Goodbye came out and was like permeating the entire, you know, religious media ecosphere or ecosystem, and you know, going through all these denominations and people started courting and trying to avoid everything. I love that you mentioned Every Young Man's Battle, because that I worked in a Christian bookstore, and so like not only did I read it, I bought it for myself, you know. I did that to myself. And that was like a, you know, a self-own, and like that aspect of the book of having a point of view character who is male and is like struggling with like the idea of trying to stay pure and also avoid like trying to not corrupt the people he's attracted to. Like that also like really hit home. And I thought was such a, it felt true to life. And like when I read through some of the other endorsements of your book, I know Mason Meniga said, you know, this feels like some of our biographies. And I think that was part of it too, is like a lot of us see, you know, all of those things where you're trying to negotiate being attracted to someone within this religious context. And it's just so wild. Like, because I, in retrospect, I feel like the people that were teaching those things to the kids in that era, like, they didn't grow up with that type of purity culture in the same way, you know? So, like, were they holding people to a different standard than they had for themselves? I still don't really know how to answer that question, because I know, like, Elizabeth Elliot was a thing, and there were predecessors to I Kissed Dating Goodbye and True Love Waits and all that stuff. But I just really loved how you presented that. And like, this is just a like, well, definitely a long compliment, but also I don't have like it's a really broad question of just, was that just so central to being a teenager that it had to be permeate the book so much? Or was that just another focus that you had as you developed the story for it?
It was definitely always going to be pretty close to front and center. Like the very, very first iteration was about the protagonist and the co-protagonist having a romantic relationship, and like that's the scandal that gets, you know, them in trouble. I eventually turned it more theological, but also kept that as well, in a way. And like a couple of people have just said like, this book is so horny. I'm like, well, yeah, it's, first of all, it's about humans. Secondly, it's about young humans. Yeah. And like they're in a world that is constantly talking to them about sex. Like you said, like this was, I think it's right to say this was, if not the peak of purity culture, it was the peak of a certain kind of
right?
Like I Kissed Dating Goodbye, like Silver Ring Thing, True Love Waits, like Rebecca St. James being trotted out on stage, and like every boy in the crowd is told like, if you want a wife who looks like her, you better do things our way. And like purity, like virginity becoming so linked with salvation, and like that to me, even looking back, does feel like a new thing opposed to, you know, previous decades, where it's like that sense of it's not just a sin, it's like the sin, you know, it's like a sin you need a special secondary extra level of forgiveness to get second virginity, like you've got to fill out a piece of paperwork for it or something. And this was before like South Park found out about it and started making fun of it, you know, like it was before it hit the mainstream enough to where like a kid who's in that world might stumble on a joke about it, you know, or like might hear the Jonas Brothers being made fun of for signaling some of its, some of its stuff, you know. It was just, we were on our own in there, you know, we didn't have pop culture to bail us out yet. They knew we were up to weird stuff. They didn't know how weird. They didn't know about the rose petal speech. They didn't know about the bubblegum speech and all that stuff. So like in the book, I sort of tried to do two things. One is show how much it absolutely sucked for the boys in this world, gay and straight. Our protagonist is straight, but you know, over time he realizes his friends have a variety of orientations. And like, I just wanted to show how much it sucks, and this is our basic level of awfulness to grow up in this world, to have a coming of age experience. And then, you know, around halfway through, he starts to realize from conversations with his female friends, like, oh no, he's on easy mode. Actually, it gets way, way, way worse. And I tried to do it fairly. Like, I can't personally speak to the female experience of growing up in that world, but I've heard and I've read and I've listened. And I heard enough at the time from girls in that world who didn't even know how to say what they were trying to say, how awful it was and how much it sucked to be told things about their dress code and like the way they were walking and like the sports they could play and just everything. And so a couple of my characters, including like, you know, the protagonists, the one he feels most protective of and empathetic toward, and like one of the ones who would be most surprising to hear those concerns and grievances voiced, you know, like I wanted, we hear it from three different female characters, very different personalities, but like I definitely wanted to show that, like, okay, here's how much it sucks for boys, and then it sucks 10 times worse for girls.
Yeah.
Cause that's how
yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that is definitely true. Like as far as purity culture, cis women are, you know, the primary victims of that system. Your book is very successful at showing like the mental anguish of how boys, cis teens and boys and men and all that, those sorts of that experience, how even though it's set up for like a much easier forgiveness for them, if they are led astray, like, you know, they become oddly like the victims, even if they're the predators or if they're
right,
or if they were willing participants, and everyone is a willing participant when the story is told, they're the victims. It put me back in that place, like in the year since I was that teenage kid and was feeling similar ways. Like I've read books like Linda K. Klein's book Pure, and the one of the lines that sticks with a lot of people is women were taught that their bodies were evil and men were taught that their minds were. And like that is what I felt was really reflective, because like there's only really one for a lot of the book, there's one who is vulgar, you know, and like yes, and talks and is frank about, you know, body parts and sexuality and all that sort of stuff, for most of the book, but it does show, you know, when in the boys talking to other boys moments, you know, they let their guards down and talk about things, yeah, a bit more with a bit more honesty.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of every young man's battle, like I would say most universally popular chapter is an accountability group scene at Pizza Hut where the boys are breaking down their homework, every young man's battle, and like on the one hand shitting all over it, like it, the horniest book I've ever written, you know. And like I really did. I said it was probably the easiest chapter to write because I just sat down with a copy of it and read it for the first time as an adult and was like, holy fuck, this is it's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even without the homophobic chapter, it's insane.
Yeah, when he like brags about how many women he slept with, and then like he got convicted at some church service and then couldn't perform. Like how do you give those? How do you assign that to teenagers that have no lived experience with their sexuality at all, and like expect them to not have a very understandable reaction to it?
Their mind immediately is going to go to like, so you're telling me I can do all that and then write this book and I'm good? Oh wait, I'm really bad for thinking about that. Like all of it is the scene in Walk Hard where John C. Reilly is offered cocaine and you know, you don't want this. It's I kind of do. No, I'm telling you, you don't want, like that is the entire experience in purity culture and really all of it. And Linda K. Klein's book, I read that and was like, ugh, like it's, oh God, like what a tough read, you know, and for very obvious reasons. And like that line about the I think I probably did, now that you put it that way, I probably did put a version of it in there where, you know, as Isaac, our protagonist, is starting to realize all this, he's like, wow, I know how much it sucks to hate one part of my body. And like my best friend has to hate her entire body, you know? So like, I didn't realize I probably took inspiration from that line, but yeah. Yeah. there is always going to be a ton about sex in here.
Yeah, but I mean, you're writing about teenagers, so why wouldn't it be? Like, even it, like, it's, you know, just because they're religious teenagers doesn't mean they're not thinking about it.
They're thinking about it even more. Yeah. I mean, I tried to open it with, like, the most relatable scene I could. It's like, it's summer camp, the kids are playing pickup football, and then the protagonist has a crush on an older girl. Like, anyone of any gender, of any orientation, any background can relate to, like, at least some of that, if not all right. of it. And at the same time, he thinks he's the horrible, most disgusting scum of the earth, loathsome spider about to be flicked into the pit of hell. Where his dad is, and it's like both of these things are true at once. Yeah. And also switch this one.
Yes, somebody's daring someone to move
at all times. Yes.
I want to talk a little bit about the relationship between Isaac and his older brother, who is this fire and brimstone guy that they are the two that are sort of in direct comparison, like, for the reader and for the protagonist himself, of like, oh man, this is my older brother, and he is like really, really focused on saving people from hell, which Isaac is iffy about the very existence of. So was that something that you drew on, like, from your own personal experience or someone else's that you knew? Because, I mean, that is also just such an element of being younger that I think, in retrospect, like, I was the religious sibling, you know, like, my sister was, but I was the hyper-involved one. And, I mean, like, she was usually one phase of life ahead of me, especially being 5.5 years older as a kid. Like, 5.5 years is like a lot, you know. She was, when I was in elementary school, she was in middle school, you know, that sort of thing. So is that something that you drew on? Because I feel like that is such a powerful type of comparison of, like, when you are a teenager, you're looking at yourself and you're looking at how other people are living and interacting with the world, and like, the fact that he had his brother there to compare himself to constantly was just one other thing that that was very, very impactful, I guess, as far as that. So I'm curious about that development as well.
So my only sibling is a younger sister who about the same age mm-hmm. gap. And I think I was probably the more had the busier religious calendar, I would say. I think I read more Breakaway magazine than she read Brio magazine, which, you know, good for her. I'm glad she avoided that for the most part. I think Isaac's older brother, it's funny how long it takes to, like, put things together and realize, like, oh, just keep it simple. Like, I had all these, like, various antagonists, and, like, they all had varying motives, and most of them were just, like, generic Christian nationalists. Everything that sucks about, like, hardcore Republican religious people, just that's it. No complexity. And then I started to realize, like, I got advice from Matthew Pierce, one of the probably the best religious Twitter account. He read it and he was like, so we know that this guy sucks, but we don't know why, you know, like, we don't know, like, why does he choose to be this way, you know, like, what makes him this way? And, like, that made me start taking things away from this character and whittling him down, and eventually Eli, the older brother, became like a thought experiment of, like, what if there were a Christian who actually believed in eternal conscious torment? Like, David Bentley Hart writes that, like, in his book about universalism, that, like, no one actually believes this shit. Like, if you did, you'd be screaming on a street corner. If you did, it would make you lose your mind. If you believed in eternal hell and you weren't yelling in everyone's faces, you're a psychopath. So, like, I just decided, okay, Eli believes in hell. He's the only one. Everyone here, kind of, like, thinks they do, and they feel bad all the time, and they think they deserve to go, and they're worried about who's there, but they're not acting as if they believe in it. So, like, Eli is the one who is putting all his money where his mouth is, and, like, constantly... like, he's deconstructing in a really weird way throughout the book. Like, he's setting aside, like, patriotism and militarism and purity culture. And, like, and like he divorces his wife because, you know, he feels that like they shouldn't have been married because she was too young, and he doesn't like the way he's been treating her, and like he makes amends for things, and like mm-hmm. he does a lot of good things, but he's just bound by this one belief that is I mean, it's tied directly to the book's origin, the story about the men bursting into the Wednesday night church and waving guns around. That's Eli's origin story. And Isaac hears about it secondhand. And like, ultimately he was like inspired by a bunch of like, you know, big beardy religious guys. But then I just sort of put those guys through a thought experiment, I guess.
Yeah, no, it's really successful because you actually, through those ways in which he, you know, you mentioned deconstructs things like purity culture and even seeming absolutes like not getting divorced and all of those types of things. He does it all in the name of of being a better evangelist, which, and mm-hmm. like you have these glimpses of like, oh, he somewhere in there is a decent fellow like this, but, and even maybe this, he's compelled by this terrible belief, where he really thinks that this is what everyone needs to avoid. And that, but then that's his tragedy too, is just how bound he is by it. And I thought seeing those comparisons and then seeing the way in which Isaac and his group of friends relate back to Eli was just fascinating. So again, that was just another really, when, as Mason said, like this being a biography, like you've probably met one or two people like this that are like in evangelism mode 100% of the time. Like mm-hmm. I went to a Christian college, and there were two siblings that went, and the brother was an evangelist all the time, and then his sister, who also went, had some of those characteristics, but there would be days when she was not in the mood, and it would just be she'd be mm-hmm. a different it'd be a different experience talking to her. And that's who I remembered when I was.
Interesting. Yeah. 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 I tried to have a bunch of characters who like, they know what the mission is. They believe in it. They want to strive for it. They love it. They think, and all this, and also they're into this or that, and they like to dabble in this and that. And just Eli's, there's no dabbling. There will never be dabbling. He does not dabble. Like, to me, he's, I guess I wanted to write the guy that we all thought we were supposed to be.
Right.
You know, the guy who's just on 24/7. The guy who is as hard on himself as he is on everyone else. Like, because there are eternal stakes. And yeah, I did try to do it sympathetically, and also in a way where it's like, this kid didn't become like this. You know, he's like mid-20s for most of the book, but in my mind, he's a kid. Mm-hmm. 'Cause like parts of him are just stuck at that, you know, stuck it in kid mode forever. Mm-hmm. Like a system made him this way. And like, it was in response to a tragedy. Like we learn in the first sentence, Isaac's dad died. That means Eli's dad died, you know? And like we learn in the first sentence, Isaac doesn't know whether his dad's being tortured in hell right now. Well, that's Eli's entire origin story is, you know, being the older brother who's even closer to the dad. And then there's a couple lines in there where, and we see it from both the like undeconstructed perspective and a bit more deconstructed, where it's like, if this point of view is right, then what, you know, like if this is how God works, then how do you respond? Do you go along with this? Do you go along with this tyrant? You know, which is, I think it's either N.T. Wright or David Bentley Hart again, who had a quote that's like, if this is God, then doesn't deserve to be worshipped, you know?
Yeah.
And ultimately that's one of the main conflicts in there. I forget something else I was going to say. It must not matter.
that's totally fine. My final question sort of about the book, I think, is just like the other, and I know that I tend to go on these longer comments and then just also want to hear how you developed it. And I think the reason why I've been sort of structuring my questions and and everything this way is that I'm just really fascinated. I'm not a fiction writer. So like, what puts you in that mode? How you take, you know, all your various experiences as well as just doing the fiction thing and creating something from whole cloth. The other aspect that I felt very lived in and realistic was just the nature of like teenage relationships, and how intense they are, and like, and then but then how at the same time they can sort of just fade away, and like the part that really drove that home for me was in this section where Isaac is talking to a friend, and like, Sophie, the other protagonist, was grounded for a long time. It's like, what's going on with you two? Have you talked to her? And he's like, eh. it's like, holy shit, that is what it was like. Like, you were head over heels infatuated with this person, and you just, you know, locked eyes, and were like, eh, like. And that's that felt like remembering what it was like to be a teenager instead of, and like, you know, so I read comics and a lot, and a lot of comics are written by middle-aged white guys, and like they have teenage characters, but they don't feel like feel like they're from a teenage. And this is where I think a novel, like, you're in the thought processes, you're in that space. So I would love to hear how you sort of approached that part of it, because these relationships are so intense and they're amplified by the youth group culture, and like all of this pressure for things to be eternal and lasting forever. And they do because they're your formative years, but not in the same way that the religion is telling you it's going to last forever.
Right.
So I would love to hear how you approach that part of the book too, because that, again, just felt like the proper representation of what that was like.
Yeah, I was thinking the other day about how a lot of fiction about young people tries to do this thing where it's essentially not about, like you said, it's not about young people, it's about an older person trying to convince us they were very cool as a young person, and not necessarily cool in the like, I had a leather jacket and I smoked a lot. Like, not necessarily cool, but like a certain kind of cool. I was too smart to do that stuff. I was aloof. I was focused on going to Brown University. I swear all YA is about going to Brown University. Like, it's all this like retroactive argument that younger me was already older me, and I was around all these teenagers, you know, and I was like, I was never going to do that. Like, we are going to wallow in teenagerness. Like, even though in the fiction, like, we're it's an older narrator looking back, so there is a tiny bit of distance, but like, I wanted him very comfortable with just throwing back directly into the moment at times. Like, the italic text you mentioned is like, it's all like emerging like a memory is the effect I was going for. There's a thing his mom says, and his mom is, at times, she's like the author just explaining why this book exists. She keeps describing like being young as like potent and vivid, and then it's gone, you know? And that's what I wanted. I wanted every scene, every chapter, all of it to have like just dramatic highs and lows smashing against each other. It's like, I think we get older and, you know, the lows don't go as low usually unless something awful has happened. You know, like just the daily, like, my friend didn't talk to me today, low, doesn't go anywhere near as low.
Yeah.
But also the highs don't go as high, you know?
Right.
And I just wanted that just like big hearted sincerity all the time, and sincerity that is like flagrantly, blatantly masked by dick jokes and fart jokes and religion stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like, there are times when if you want to tell someone how you feel, you have to say like, the Lord put you on my heart, you know, like,
right.
You can't actually tell them how you feel. So like, it's just wallowing in sincerity, but a like realistic sincerity, I guess. These are still young people living in toxic masculinity and the patriarchy and like a religious world that encourages certain emotions to be huge and certain to be invisible. And like, I don't know. I think there's another thing Isaac's mom says where it's like a lot of adults look at young people and they're just embarrassed because they recognize themselves. And like, I don't know. I think young people are hilarious. I think they're brilliant in their own way. Like, you know, I listen to my daughter and her friends talk and I'm like, you're such little geniuses. Weird things you say. It's not until people turn like 24 that I'm like, oh, okay, I don't need to follow you. We'll check back in on you when you're 30. You know, it's like mid-20s that I'm out on. But teenagers, they're brilliant. So like, I don't know. I guess it's just a comfort with, I'm cool with my narrator sounding like the cringiest person in the world at times. Like in the first chapter, there's a couple moments where he's like, I'm recording the audiobook right now and I'm like, good Lord, I have to like go for this Adam Sandler accent he's doing. but like, there are moments when it's like, you're good. You, the reader, are good with this book being like completely realistic about teenagers and like whether they're in Super Bad was a text I looked at a lot. That's a good way to describe Superbad. But like the way the kids in Superbad talk to each other, where it's like, yeah, they're little shitheads and they adore each other.
Right.
You know, and like they find a couple moments to express that. Or like the way in Kids Lady Bird was another where like, you know, yeah, she's kind of horrible to her mom at times. And she loves nothing in this world more than her mother. And the other was Eighth Grade. The dialogue in Eighth Grade is the most realistic dialogue in any movie ever made. I don't even know how they wrote that movie. Like, it's just nonstop stuttering and noises. And it just sounds like actual eighth graders talking to each other. So, I guess I committed to... everyone here is going to sound like who they are, not like the author putting on their costume, I guess.
right. Yeah. Well, I think it would, I mean, I've really enjoyed reading the book. If you couldn't tell.
Thank you.
I'm really glad to have been able to talk to you a little bit about what went into the writing process and into developing these characters in this novel. I also would love to hear, you did also donate the proceeds from the book for the first, how many months, 3 or 4 months of the, or two? I'm sorry, I don't have it written down. I apologize.
Three-ish. It was from like Thanksgiving through Valentine's Day,
okay.
Basically.
So yeah, if you could talk a little bit about the organization that you donated to, and then also what compelled you to also use part of the proceeds of your book in that manner.
So we have pledged from those proceeds $56,000 to the Trevor Project. We've donated most of it so far. We'll finish the rest up as they finish arriving. For anyone who doesn't know, they are a self-harm prevention charity focused on young LGBTQ people. And I don't know, it was this thing where I just sort of looked up one day and realized that this Google Doc was going to make, somebody will buy it. It'll make at least $15. I don't know. And I was like, what do I do with those $15? And it was just, I had this sense of like, well, I don't need them. The book has already like completely rewired my brain as I discovered it. And like, you know, changed my spirituality and like, changed the way I think about, you know, giving me empathy for people who grew up like me and, you know, enabled me to forgive myself. Like, it's done all these things for me. I don't need it to do money for me as well. I'm very like lucky to have a career that pays the bills and stuff. So I knew the money was going to go somewhere. And I never, you know, it was sort of like, well, there's a Trevor Project. And then I never really thought to a second option. It's just like, yep, that's the one. Because like, you know, not only does it relate to the book's themes of like the protagonist and like most of his friends learning to become allies, including to themselves, some of them. It also, you know, it relates to my own life of like, you know, one of my first deconstruction moments was realizing like, I don't care if the Bible's right. I don't like the way my friends feel about themselves,
right.
You know. And then many years later realizing like, oh, that's not actually what the Bible says. But like, that sense of this is the way people who were raised like me treat a select group of people, many of whom were also raised like me, that's unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, I knew I didn't like it and I knew I was unhappy about it, but I didn't really realize until like 2/3 of the way through writing this, how like pissed off I am about what I witnessed, you know, when I was in the church, like the things my LGBTQ friends said about themselves, you know, and the way they felt about themselves. So yeah, the book's launch plus our launch party, Sold Out Brewery in Atlanta, which is a, which is a ridiculous time. yeah, it, hopefully it'll do some good for, you know, for people who are affected by a lot of, queerphobic symptoms, a major one of which is right-wing religion.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Jason, thank you so much for talking to me about your book. Again, the book is called Hell as a World Without You. I'll have a link to where you can purchase it in the show notes for this show. You also do a number of other things. So anything else you'd like to plug, feel free to do so.
The most relevant one, other one, is Vacation Bible School, the podcast I do with my wife. We started in Genesis, and we have almost four years later, we have entered the Book of Kings. It's not the fastest pace in the world, but we've had on Mason. You mentioned Mason a few times. Mm-hmm. We've had on Andrew Whitehead, April LaJoy, and you know some scholars of religion in addition to Andrew. And then, you know, also at the same time, just some of our friends. It's all from a deconstructing point of view, all from a LGBTQ affirming point of view. Definitely not trying to push any particular religion. It wasn't until the past few months when I realized, like, oh, I guess I'm kind of still a Christian. So it would be pretty hypocritical of me to spend the first 3 years like pushing anyone one way or the other. But yeah, there's that. And then also for anyone who's interested in audiobook of the novel, we are working on that.
Awesome. Right. Awesome. Jason, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Blake. Thank you for having me. This is a blast.
That'll do it for today's episode. Let me know what you think by sending me a message over at contact@evangelicalpodcast.com. If you appreciate the show, leave a rating or a review over on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And finally, if you want to support the show directly, you can do so through a paid subscription to the Post Evangelical Post at postevangelicalpost.com. All right, talk to you later.